I'm Eric Von Crumley.
And I'm Romy Reyes.
Have you ever wondered how a book becomes a movie?
Or how a movie becomes a musical?
Or how anything is adapted at all?
Join us as we talk about your favorite stories and all the changes that were made along the way.
But more importantly, why? This is Willing to Adapt.
Hi, welcome back to Willing to Adapt. I am Eric Von Crumley.
And I'm Romy Reyes.
How's it going?
I'm doing good. How about you?
Good. You know, I always think, how are we going to start this episode? I don't know how to ease into this. And inevitably, we come up with some nonsense.
Today, we're talking about the importance of being Romy.
Close. Half the listeners who don't pay attention are thinking the importance of being Roman.
Don't worry. I get so many different variations of my name. We might have talked about this in the past.
We did. We talked about it a couple episodes ago.
Yeah.
I think so. Yeah.
In fact, recently...
Because I remember being frustrated that people can't pronounce Romy.
Yes, I know. In fact, I think it was Starbucks. I was like, Romy? Romy? Never understood it.
Romaldo.
I wouldn't be surprised one day if I get that one.
All right. Today we're talking about the importance of being earnest. A play by Oscar Wilde and the 2002 film adaptation. Were you aware of this play before I told you that we should do this one?
I was, actually. It's, even though I've never read it and haven't come across, I've not had the opportunity to either watch it or read it before. It is something that was in the background of my mind, only because growing up, I don't know if I remember if I mentioned this in a previous podcast, but I went by a different name. Ernest. Yes. Ernie. And so I vaguely remember hearing about it in high school, maybe, and then
it makes sense.
People making fun
probably
of
in some
it
English
or
class
joking
or
about it or something.
Or maybe in your drama class.
Possibly, but yeah.
That's where you first heard about Pygmalion and My Fair Lady. So
true. Yeah.
Makes some sense.
So, and of course, being earnest, it was the importance of being Romy earnest.
I think we need to explain to our listeners what the word earnest means.
Based on the play or like
in general,
dictionary?
The word earnest.
I mean, I know what it means, but I haven't looked up a dictionary.
It means
version.
Sincere.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, like you're being truthful. You're being.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like there's probably a little more to it than that, but that's the gist of it.
Yeah.
So if someone was saying something to you like, hey, I just went and, you know, blew up a mountain, and they say, are you earnest? And like, yes, I actually did that.
I don't think I've ever heard anyone use
just,
the word.
I
like
just came
that.
Up with. Well, people used to. It's not so
true,
much now.
True, true.
Like, you could read older literature and you'll find it.
So basically, it's for those who are of a contemporary generation, it's the same as no cap. Eric is looking at me very fun, very intently. I don't think he liked the use of slang there.
I'm not on any social media.
Have you heard of no cap?
I heard someone mention it.
Okay, yep. So...
I don't even mess with it anymore.
It's not social media. Actually, the funny thing is I was listening to a podcast by a reporter who is a millennial, and every now and then he'll use no cap, or I'll come across it in like articles, which is to me almost egregious in, you know, usage of language today. But anyway,
you look like you were physically in pain.
Yeah, but then some friends of mine, they like to judiciously use that phrase.
All right. So I thought it was important to explain that word too, because I knew that's a word that's not in very common parlance.
Correct.
And so I wanted the listeners to understand that the title of the play is a pun, because it is about a character named Ernest, or who wants to be called Ernest, I guess. And it's still a pun.
Yes.
All right. So you want to jump into a little bit of the background of Oscar Wilde first?
Sure. I can go through the chronology.
Yeah, I'll pick up the whatever you don't hit. How about that?
Yeah. So the chronology I'm using is from the version I read, which is The Importance of Being Earnest in Other Plays by the Signet Classics. These are all by Oscar Wilde.
And it has such a very pretty cover.
It does. I really didn't pay attention. And so this
like,
is
oh,
one
sure.
of three plays, right? Three of his popular plays. I think he wrote some other before these.
Oh, he's written a bunch.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's most famous for this one.
Mm-hmm.
He was also famous for Lady Windermere's Fan, which was before this. This was like his last big one.
And that one's included in this volume.
Mm-hmm. But other than this one, I think you were going to say the book he wrote, right? Like the only book.
Oh, in fact, I was going to mention that earlier. That's how I think I came across, even though Oscar Wilde wrote The Pictures of Dorian Gray and this one, and I'd heard of this play. Back when I heard of it in high school, I didn't realize it was written by him for a while,
mm-hmm.
because Picture of Dorian Gray was actually my first introduction to
Oscar Wilde. So you read it?
No, I haven't. Okay. It was mentioned in a movie something that I watched.
The Movie for a Gentleman?
It was... actually, wasn't the movie. It was
the movie that gets every literature wrong.
I know.
That's when I was first introduced to Dorian Gray. In A League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. And I was like, oh, I want to read that. And I was like, oh, it's very different.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, essentially, Oscar Wilde was born in Dublin on October 16th. And he was born in the year 1854. His father was a distinguished eye and ear specialist. And his mother was a woman with literary and Irish nationalistic interests. He attended Trinity College in Dublin, where he won a medal.
Beautiful college, by the way.
You seen it?
I've been there.
Really?
Yeah, they have the Book of Kells there.
Wow, that's cool.
That's the library. I wanted to go there because their library.
Oh,
they have that really beautiful library. It's like all like old, dark wood, and you've seen pictures of it. You just don't know that's what it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
When did you go to Ireland?
Back in 2017.
Okay. How did I not know this?
We talked about this. It's when I was backpacking in Europe.
Actually, it's very coming back
to my... Did you have an aneurysm?
No, but there's a lot of times I forget things. And a lot of things blend together in my mind sometimes, so I have to kind of parse them out.
Right.
But I vaguely remember that conversation now. So anyway, he went to Trinity College, won a medal for Greek. He matriculate means graduate, right?
I think so.
Yeah, he matriculated at Magdalen College in Oxford. He won a prize called the Newdigate Prize for poetry.
Just commit to it and nobody will question
That's true. His first publication was of a book of poems. He then went on a lecture tour in the United States and Canada, where when they asked what if he was bringing anything into the country, I read this somewhere, he said, my genius, or something along those lines. He did The Picture of Dorian Gray in 1891. He met Lord Alfred Douglas, who plays heavily in his biography, his life, in 1891 as well. That's also when he wrote Lady Windermere's Fan and Salome. The Salome, I know, was not performed in England at the time. He couldn't even actually get that published, if I remember right, in England, because they had some sort of law that prohibits publication or any type of production of biblical stories or biblical characters.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I mean, the Church of England was very powerful.
Yeah, in fact, I read
theater for a very long time in England was mm-hmm. very strict.
Oh, okay.
Like proper like theater.
Mm-hmm.
It was I can't remember. There was like a law about it because theater back in like 1700s was very political and was like causing rebellions and stuff. And so they basically made a law saying like only like a certain theater or two could put on like real professional plays.
Okay.
But that was like real theater.
Okay.
And so if any other theater existed, it had to be like lesser. Like it had to include music or something. So, like it couldn't be, you couldn't have like a real play. You had to include like music and dancing and stuff so that you could say it's not real theater. Like it's just more fun and stuff, you know. You can get away around the censors that way.
Okay. That makes sense. Yeah, this one, it was a prohibition originating from Puritan opposition to the old Roman Catholic mystery plays. And they could not... The Salome was refused a license because it violated the centuries-old prohibition against portraying biblical characters. It wasn't until 1968 that this statute was removed. However, they had stopped enforcing it several decades earlier. So that was that one. I know I remember reading that. So at that place, Salome was published in French. He did Lady Windermere's Fan, A Woman of No Importance, another play. He published the English translation of Salome in 1894. That's also when he wrote The Importance of Being Earnest. And in 1895, he produced An Ideal Husband. That is also the year on February 14th when he went to court is taken to court by Alfred Douglas's father, the Marquis of Queensberry, to court on a charge of libel, and he lost the case. And then right after the case, he was arrested for homosexuality. He was sentenced to 2 years of hard labor.
Well, I think to be fair, it's the acts that he was...
True. I'm reading it as it is here.
The world was very much aware of of his predilections. It was just... They now finally had proof that, like, he was physically doing things with other men.
And I think it was more the idea of the Marquis of Queensberry just wanted him out of the way and out of his life.
Well, he was
life.
Causing trouble.
Yeah. And so he sentenced to 2 years of hard labor. He spent most of this period imprisoned in the Reading Gaol. Gaol. Okay. Finally, he was released from jail on May 19th. He went to France. And he pretty much stayed in France the rest of his life. He visited other parts of Europe. The publication of The Importance of Being Earnest happened in 1899, and then he passed away. He died in Paris on November 30th of 1900. So that's a really rough sketch of his life.
Yep.
Now I know you're going to fill us in.
No, that's pretty good. No.
Okay.
No, there wasn't really anything else that I think we need to cover. This isn't... The episode's not about him. It's just good to know... about him so we can discuss some things down the road in this.
That would be actually a good podcast, biographies. Anyway, go ahead.
That would be interesting. Maybe sometime down the road. I don't know. Do people want to listen to that?
I would.
I mean, I guess that's true. I mean...
Like short and sweet biographies where we don't get too depth. Okay, we'll talk about this off.
We kind of did that already.
I know.
Our listeners are like, do you really want to go more in depth? All right. The Importance of Being Earnest is, I would say, and I think you touched upon it, is his most popular work, other than maybe The Picture of Dorian Gray, which is vastly different.
Yeah.
Picture of Dorian Gray is like a gothic novel. It's serious, it's very sincere, and this is a pure comedy.
Yeah.
Like, trivial comedy.
That's what I didn't read the review, but I read about a review from George Bernard Shaw.
Mm-hmm.
Who hated it?
It's funny because it seemed like George Bernard Shaw did not like the play, but he really liked Oscar Wilde.
Yes, because he liked all his other plays, but he didn't like this one because he said it was very trivial. And
I think Oscar Wilde is like one of the few people in like the Victorian period who was trying to live an aesthetic like they do nowadays.
Yeah, no, that I think I read that somewhere too.
He had a very distinctive style. It was like velvet jackets, and he would wear knee breeches and big bow ties and
the dandy.
Yes, he was very much a dandy, but like not even exactly in style with the time. Well, one of the things that I can't remember if you touched on it, there was a period in the Victorian period called the aesthetic movement.
I vaguely remember reading about that,
and at the bare minimum, I'm just going to say it's how he says art for art's sake.
Yes.
Like, and I don't really want to go too much into that because that's a rabbit hole, but
yeah,
you can see like just in like how he dressed and like you can see in the later Victorian period, like even going into, you know, like the craftsman movement and stuff, like you can see how like it was pushed towards that because that was in response to industrialism.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I know they kind of attribute his previous plays, especially Salome, to that idea. But I honestly didn't...
He had a lot of lofty ideas. Like, he was very philosophical. He also was kind of like a jokester.
Okay.
From what I could tell. And he was very complicated. I don't really know enough about him to maybe go too much further. But... like, the one thing I thought was interesting is at the end of his life, before he died, like, he was accepted into the Catholic Church. Huh. And apparently he, like, always loved the Catholic Church.
Wow, that's interesting.
Which I think is very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, people are full of surprises. So.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I think that's one thing that, like, people, like, in, like, the LGBT community who love Oscar Wilde, obviously. Like, they don't think about that.
Yeah. That's something I've noted. This did cross my mind when I was reading the short biography, or the afterword was done by a different author than the introduction. And the introduction was a little too technical at times, and I was short on time, so I kind of skipped it. So I read
think
the afterword.
Sometimes introductions are just someone's excuse to just hear themselves
That's kind of what I, that's the impression I got. Also from the afterword too, there was a little bit of that. But what I really liked about it was he made a statement, or they made a statement, because it was two people co-authoring it, in that one of the mistakes people make today is they try to look for clues of what the author is like based on their art. And they were saying how, yeah, you can pick something here and there and maybe come out of it, but it's often a folly because you don't know. And I think that's one of the things I did read about his different plays, was that they were so all over the place that they really don't give a cohesive version of, like, there's some people which I think they're very, I don't want, this is kind of mean, but I don't mean to say they're simplistic, but they're very, what would be a, some people are, you know what you're going to get from them.
Oh, for sure.
And if they wrote a story, you know what it's going to be.
Right.
And I think people who are good at art can go all over the place, and you really don't know what you're going to get from them. Not.
I think that's when you get a well-rounded person with a very wide range of interests.
Yeah.
Who does their research and is curious.
Yes. And the one thing I've learned about today, contemporary ideologies, is that a lot of people want things to be simplistic. And that's something when you, you know, when you mentioned the LGBT movement, that's to distinguish it from LGBT people. They're actually two different things. I think often when you see the movement in the public, just like most other movement, whether they be, you know, evangelical Christianity, whether it be academics, whether it be teachers, whether it be what, you know, they want the world to be overly simplistic. And they don't understand the beauty of the nuance that comes from people, and or even especially the past. And I think even more so works. You know, and this is one of the reasons why I love this podcast, is because we're able to explore works that are often more nuanced. Heck, who would have thought, you know, even like Roger Rabbit could be nuanced.
I know.
And that was one of the things when I first began reading the play, I was a little bored.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I was. It was kind of like, okay, there's another play.
I mean, it makes sense. I feel like I've always kind of been aware of the importance of being earnest. I think I might have watched it the first time in high school.
Okay.
But, you know, growing up in theater, like, it was just one of the plays that kind of floated around. I was aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
But because I knew what was coming, it didn't deter me.
I will say once I got to Act 2, it...
Oh, you had to get all the way to Act 2.
Okay, so...
You didn't even wait until, like, Lady Bracknell didn't do it for you?
It did. Okay, so it did start somewhat. So I was kind of bored in the beginning.
Did you read it? I know I gave you the book to read, but...
I did read it.
Okay, so it's...
So I acted it out while I was reading it to some degree.
Yeah. It's very helpful to at least hear.
That's, and I told you, I think I mentioned before we started recording that I listened to a college production.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. Because once I listened to them say it out loud, it brought a different, way of looking at it.
Yeah. Cause you, again, just how we talked about the Shakespeare, Much Ado About Nothing,
mm-hmm.
where you can listen to it without watching it and you can understand what's happening.
Yeah.
It's similar. This one,
mm-hmm.
You get more nuances and you get maybe some more jokes,
mm-hmm.
like visual jokes when you're watching it, but you can just listen to it. And that's key because a lot of it is in how these actors are giving their lines and the speed too. It's very similar to George Bernard Shaw, and like he just had very good dialogue and very witty dialogue. And like, if you don't say it the right way, it's just going to fall flat.
I can see, too, now why also, though, it's not very well known. Because one thing I think I've learned, especially as we've gone through the podcast, is that a lot of good art has fallen to the wayside because of the, I don't know, lack of attention span, or because there's no good movie about it.
Well, when people have access to everything they would ever want,
mm-hmm.
you would think that they would branch out, but people are comfortable with what they know. Like either what's modern or what their friends are watching or things like that. Whereas when we were younger, we were more limited. Mm-hmm. And so if you didn't have something to watch or you didn't have something to read, you might have picked up something. Or mm-hmm. someone might have said, hey, why don't you try this? You might have tried it.
Yeah.
I mean, you have the choice still, but it's a little different.
It is.
It's
it
weird because it's ironic. And I've told people this before. It's ironic that we have access to such a wide range of things like mm-hmm. books, movies, television, anything, and yet most people actually don't branch out at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what's ironic about it.
So here's a question. how many people around you, I know you're in a different world than me, like when you bring this one up, how many people actually have heard of it?
No, most people have not.
No, yeah, okay. So yeah. Same as me.
I mean, when I was in theater, everybody knows.
Yeah, yeah.
Almost that everybody. Unless they like just started doing theater or like only really like musicals or something. Like if you grew up doing theater, like you're aware of this play.
Okay. That makes sense, yeah. Because like I said, most people, heck, I even if think they don't even know what The Picture of Dorian Gray is. That's the sad reality. So.
Yeah, but I will say The Importance of Being Earnest is so popular and remains so popular that it seems like every year someone is doing it. Whether it's a high school or a professional or whatever, someone is always doing it because it's always popular.
Okay.
Like even for people who've never seen it, who go to see it, it's popular. It's just, you know, getting people in the seats.
Yeah. I read it out loud while I was reading the play. And so my wife got to, you know, she listens to me. I usually kind of read to her. And it was funny. She enjoyed it, just hearing me read it. You know, and so I was like, you know, there is something to these, some of these works here. If we would just branch out and try them.
All right. From Spark Notes. The Importance of Being Earnest by Oscar Wilde, first performed in 1895. Is a comedic play that satirizes the conventions and the manners of Victorian society. The subtitle of the play, A Trivial Comedy for Serious People, aptly captures Wilde's tongue-in-cheek take on the cultural milieu to which he was subject. Set in England during the late 19th century, the play follows the lives of two young men, Jack Worthing and Algernon Moncrief, who adopt fictional identities to escape social obligations. Algernon calls it bumbering, based off the character he made. Jack invents a brother named Ernest, while Algernon creates an invalid friend named Bunbury. The plot unfolds with mistaken identities, clever wordplay, and humorous social commentary. Wilde uses the play to mock the hypocrisy and artificiality of the upper class, exposing the trivial concerns and absurdities of his society. The characters navigate a world of romantic entanglements and societal expectations, with the theme of the importance of being earnest serving as a playful and ironic commentary on the values of honesty and sincerity. Emblematic of Wilde's send-up of the upper class is the unforgettable character of Lady Bracknell, who is utterly respectable, despite making a point to insult almost everyone she meets. Lady Bracknell is always more concerned with increasing her social and financial status than with creating a grounded relational connections. The Importance of Being Earnest is celebrated for its witty dialogue, clever satire, and timeless humor. Wilde's sharp social commentary remains relevant, making the play a classic in the canon of English literature. So in The Importance of Being Earnest, as we said, you know, both Jack, who pretends to be Ernest while he's in the town, and Algernon, who pretends to be Bunbury, they both have like their own motives. And it turns out that Jack wants to marry Gwendolyn, who is Algernon's cousin, and Lady Bracknell's daughter. But Lady Bracknell does not want him to marry Gwendolyn. And should I just read it? Should I just read the really long synopsis?
I mean, no, you're doing good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Lady Bracknell does not want Jack to marry Gwendolyn because she finds out that he does not know who his true family is because he was adopted after being found in a bag at a train station.
Yep.
and Gwendolyn loves him anyways, but part of the reason she loves him is because of his name, which she knows as Ernest. And so he doesn't want to tell her his name's not Ernest. He also doesn't want to tell her that he has a ward left to him by the man that took him in named Cecily. So Algernon ends up going and he goes and meets Cecily and he pretends to be Ernest.
Correct.
And that would be Jack's brother in this version. And so they like fall in love really quickly. She's ridiculous because she's like apparently been in love with Ernest for forever.
3 months.
And they've been engaged for 3 months. But
that's what it was.
Like, yeah. But obviously she's making it up. It's in her imagination. And that's actually really funny, the way she does it. So like, I had to break it off. You're like, why would you break it off? Any serious engagement breaks off at least once.
I did tell that to my my wife, and
yes,
she said we should have broken it off at least once, but we didn't. because it wasn't a serious
too
engagement.
Late now. But then, you know, Jack comes back, mm-hmm. and he's decided to kill off Ernest. But because Algernon's already there pretending to be Ernest, it ruins his plans.
Yes.
And so he has to admit to everybody that Algernon is Ernest so that he doesn't get in trouble, essentially.
Yeah.
And he's very angry, obviously. And while they're doing their thing, and of course, you know, there's Miss Prism, who is mm-hmm. Cecily's,
governess.
Thank you, governess. Teaching her things. And she has, like, a bit of a flirtation with the, the vicar, the rectory? Mm-hmm.
The vicar.
Yeah. Dr. Chasuble.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like he's almost such a throwaway character. Like, he's important because both Algernon and Jack want to be rechristened under Ernest so that they can tell the ladies that their names are Ernest.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes sense. And Gwendolyn appears, and apparently she's run away to be with Jack. And of course she doesn't know his name's Jack.
Yeah.
And so there's a miscommunication where she and Cecily kind of get really catty with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, I'm engaged to Ernest. Well, I'm engaged to Ernest.
Yep.
And it turns out that neither of them are engaged to Ernest. Mm-hmm. And then the truth comes out and they're very angry, but they come around very quick.
Yeah.
Because they essentially just want the guys to follow them in.
Mm-hmm.
The guys, like, get at each other over muffins.
Mm-hmm.
I love how the story sounds ridiculous when I'm summarizing it. And,
yeah, watching a performance gives it justice.
Yes, it does. It does. The key is that nothing really matters.
Yeah.
It's never taken seriously at all. And, so the truth comes out and they go and tell the ladies they're going to be rechristened because mm-hmm. they want to be with them, and the ladies are happy, and that's when Lady Bracknell shows up again.
Yep.
And she's angry, of course. And she finds out that Algernon wants to marry Cecily. And she is unsure at first because Cecily is young and not so very pretty and everything. And then she finds out that Cecily's inheriting a lot of money. And mm-hmm. it's just like, and second thought, she's actually quite pretty. And we can make her prettier. Mm-hmm.
Can fix all these things later.
Yes. We can get a nice French maid mm-hmm. to make her pretty. And of course, Jack takes it upon himself to say Cecily cannot marry Algernon unless Lady Bracknell agrees to allow Gwendolyn to marry him,
mm-hmm.
which she does not want. And then, of course, during this time, Dr. Chasuble comes looking for Miss Prism, and Lady Bracknell hears of this, mm-hmm. and she becomes enraged and then confronts Miss Prism, and you find out, almost randomly, it's kind of hinted at early, but very, very randomly, where is the baby? And it turns out that Miss Prism, at one time, 30 years ago, accidentally switched out a baby and a 3-volume novel that she had written. So she put the novel in the perambulator, which yeah. is like a stroller, and she put the baby in the handbag. And so then this is when Jack finds out, oh my gosh, that was me.
Mm-hmm.
And so he produces the handbag, and it's hers, and he thinks it's Miss Prism's his mother, but she's not. And so you find out that from Lady Bracknell that mm-hmm. Jack is actually Algernon's brother.
Yes.
And so they try to figure out what his real name is,
mm-hmm.
and they look in the book to figure out the name of his father from, because he was in the military, and so he has a military personnel book,
mm-hmm.
and you find out that his name actually truly is Ernest.
Yeah.
And basically, that's how the play ends. He says yeah. he's finally understood the importance of being earnest.
And what was the meaning of earnest?
Like sincerity, truthfulness.
That's the irony.
Mm-hmm. It's actually a lot of fun. It's ridiculous.
It sounds. That's why I think when I first,
Lady Bracknell has the best lines. I will say.
Oh, it is Ernest John. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Christian names, Ernest John.
Which I thought was funny, because his real name is John. Jack is just the short name. Mm-hmm. It's like the family name. And so I thought it was funny that his name technically is still John.
Mm-hmm. But his first name ended up being Ernest. No, it was, like I said, once I read it through, especially Act 3 is when things start getting kind of rolling along really quickly. And it was entertaining, not going to lie.
Yeah, for sure. I want to say a couple of my favorite Lady Bracknell lines, just for the fun of it.
go for it.
So she says, I do not approve of anything that tampers with natural ignorance. Ignorance is like a delicate, exotic fruit. Touch it and the bloom is gone. When she finds out early on that Jack, or Ernest as he's going by, was found in a handbag in the cloakroom of a train station as a baby, and Lady Bracknell is enraged and confused, and she says, to be born, or at any rate bred, in a handbag, whether it had handles or not, seems to me to display a contempt for the ordinary decencies of family life that reminds one of the worst excesses of the French Revolution. Her lines are the best. Like, everybody has great lines, yeah. But hers are the best. She always kills. She says, 35 is a very attractive age. London society is full of women of the very highest birth who have, of their own free choice, remained 35 for years. Okay, last one. Never speak disrespectfully of society, Algernon. Only people who can't get into it do that. Yeah. It's a very witty, it's very fun, and it's just not meant to be taken seriously. Like, yeah. Like, it almost has no point.
there's no lesson that you're going to really walk away learning from unless you really want to.
I think the only thing to take away from it is that it's truly just to make fun of the time period it was written in.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how seriously the Victorians took themselves.
Yeah.
And, like, how the high morals that they professed. And you read it understanding some of that, then you can see how Oscar Wilde purposefully, like put it on its head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, there's, like, they'll flat out state things as a fact, as, like, a moral fact that was contradictory to the time period.
Yeah.
Like, just for the humor of it.
Mm-hmm.
Did you enjoy it?
I did. I did enjoy the read-through of it, and then, like I said, the little bit of the play that I watched.
The one thing that I noticed in some of my research is some people were saying they thought that Ernest was slang for gay.
Oh, okay.
And that it was like Oscar Wilde kind of being kind of clever in his title and kind of saying, like, what does that really mean then? Like, after you look at everything that happens in the play, like, the importance is being gay.
Mm-hmm.
And I was finding a couple different things. Some people were making the argument that in the play, when these characters go bundering, that it's actually them, like, going off and, like, meeting men.
Mm-hmm.
When there's, like, no evidence of that in the play.
Yeah. Well, in a way, that kind of resembles the whole, in our previous podcast about Sleeping Beauty, and we talked about how people read into, I think I brought up Red Riding Hood, and they read into it things that didn't exist until the psychoanalyst brought it into it. And it's actually for details that were added later. I think some of what I read too in the afterword, it was along those lines in which this play, the person I read pretty much agrees that it's just a play.
Mm-hmm.
And to read too much into it, in fact,
like, he really didn't really mean to do anything. It just really was for the fun of it.
Yeah. And that sometimes artists do create things just to create them. Honestly, it was more along the lines of, I want to say someone might have said something to Oscar Wilde about doing something less serious or something along those lines. Correct me, listeners, if you know the full story, but I'm pretty sure I read that somewhere. I just can't find it now, in which he wanted to create something just for the pleasure of it. Not because I think a lot of the other stuff he had done there was more of an artistic message he was trying to get across, or at least in regards to, like you were saying earlier, art for art's sake and the aesthetic movement and all that. So sometimes, yeah, we can read too much into these things. But overall, I have to admit, going from being kind of a little leery and a little bored, when you really get into the way he wrote, and it was just written very, like, I love reading that back and forth, and especially when you know the characters are not quite on the they're not quite understanding each other, like Lady Bracknell. And it's fun to, like, if you ever do pick up a copy of this play and you don't watch it and you actually do read it, I highly recommend reading it out loud. I try to do different, little bit slightly different voices for the different characters. And it does bring it to life in a way that other things, you know, just reading it flatly doesn't.
Yeah, I'm going to read something real quick here.
Sure.
The importance of being earnest is above all an exercise in wit. There is nothing to be learned from it. No moral, no message. It adopts what one suspects was Wilde's approach to sex. More fun to talk about than to do. As Algernon observes, romance dies when a proposal is accepted.
Mm-hmm.
The very essence of romance is uncertainty. Wilde takes this as his guide. When the play's uncertainties have all been exhausted, the play ends.
Yep.
The last line, I've now realized for the first time in my life the vital importance of being earnest, takes on an interesting spin.
Mm-hmm. Who is that from?
I wish I could remember.
Oh.
I'm sorry.
No
worries. I screenshotted it. It was like a critic source, but...
Yeah.
This one is from... Oh, what's that critic's name? Darn it. Roger Ebert.
Okay.
Roger Ebert. This is in regards to the film, but mm-hmm. I will say, because he talks about the play.
Mm-hmm.
Roger Ebert said, Oscar Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest is a comedy constructed out of thin air. It is not really about anything. There are two romances at the center, but no one much cares whether the lovers find happiness together. Their purpose is to make elegant farce out of mistaken identities. The class system, mannerisms, egos, rivalries, sexual warfare, and verbal playfulness. But yeah, I think it's a lot of fun.
Nope, I agree.
I think it's actually much more approachable than people think it is. I would recommend watching it if you find a local production. I will say that when I was reading it this last time, I think one reason why I think it's still very popular,
mm-hmm.
and you can disagree with me, but I would like your input. It felt very much like a sitcom.
I can see. In fact, I want to say that kind of crossed my mind earlier when we were discussing, I can't remember what it was.
Like it almost felt like but it should be an episode of Friends or something.
If it was well written, yes.
Yes, if it was well written, yes.
No, and in some ways I think it was an early version of that type of
You can
of
see how we've production. Progressed from this.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not progress.
You can see how we moved from this.
Yes, we have. Yeah, if it was done wittily.
Because you get mistaken identities, you get, girls fighting with each other because of confusion mm-hmm. and, but like pretending like they're best friends at the same time. And
yes. So in fact, it was funny because as I was preparing for the podcast, for the recording, I even wondered like how I started wondering like it would be really cool to try to write something contemporary, but do it in a higher art form type of way, writing wise, like witty, basically not just your common everyday.
Sure. Parlance.
Yeah. Fair.
Like thunder. No, I like that. That'd be fun. I don't know what that would look like.
Though. I know. Cause I was like, in my mind,
what that is? I figured out what it is. You know what it is? It's Frasier.
Oh, that's true.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because we were talking before this one, before we began recording, in regards to just the state of contemporary, at least movies.
Yeah.
But I think the same goes for, we also mentioned TV shows. And I think a lot of TV shows they're mind-numbing entertainment. Not to say that's a bad thing, because sometimes you need a mind-numbing moment.
Yeah, sometimes.
But other times, it's nice to have well-written works of art that are entertaining, but also thought-provoking. Yeah. Not necessarily like this. I think that's the difference here, is where maybe some of his other plays were thought-provoking in a different way. Right. I haven't read them yet. I don't know.
It's like, I love to read Shakespeare, but I also like to watch The Simpsons.
Yes, exactly. And I think the same thing here, where it's like you have the... I think that's why Bernard Shaw hated this particular play, was because whereas the other ones were a lot more... There was a lot you could probably read out of them, perhaps. This one, it was just entertainment.
Which, it's so memorable, though.
It is. It is.
Like, you just walk away happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right.
So if you want to stick around for our next episode coming out, we're going to discuss the adaptation of this play and how it was turned into the 2002 movie, The Importance of Being Earnest.
Yep. All right. That's next time.
Yes. There are some changes that were made for sure.
Next time on Willing to Adapt.
All right, so just a reminder, today we are talking about the 2002 film adaptation of The Importance of Being Earnest.
Mm-hmm.
It basically takes the plot of The Importance of Being Earnest and rearranges some things.
Mm-hmm.
And adds some things and omits some things.
Yep.
It's like I'm trying to purposely be vague. And I think I like the movie less now.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. Like Gwendolyn getting a tattoo on her backside of Ernest.
That was dumb.
I know, the movie really leaned into the sexiness.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay, someone pour some water on her. But I just really feel like he really took away from the wit and what made, and a lot of the heart of the play.
Yeah.
I don't like the film.
Mm-hmm.
But if it gets people interested in Oscar Wilde, then fine.
A gateway.
Yes, if it's a gateway drug to Oscar Wilde.
Thank you for listening to our podcast, Willing to Adapt.
Please like and subscribe. Maybe leave a review or just share us with friends and family.
We would also love if you would follow us on social media.
If you have ideas for future episodes for us, please email us at ericandromi@willingtoadapt.com.
That's Romy with an I.
And remember, when the only thing constant in life is change, be willing to adapt.